unequivocally that Americans are free to travel wherever they want. Yet the executive branch of the government forbids travel to Cuba, it forbids travel to Venezuela, it forbids travel to Iran, except under special circumstances. And, of course, if you are going to attend a conference that's being promoted by a group that's been sanctioned by the Treasury Department, you are subject to astonishing fines and prison term. And the conference sounded very interesting. I knew people who were going. They were who I knew by reputation and would love to have met in person. And since I went to the one 3 years ago now, I would have loved to have gone back and met a number of people that I might have not met before, or new people that I could make acquaintance with and renew old relationships. So it's it personally harmed me, and I think it harmed the everyone's view of the United States. That only non-Americans might be able to go to a conference that supposedly is based on free exchange and fair exchange of ideas and viewpoints, and that the people involved are able to speak their minds no matter what they say, where they say it, or where they're from. And it goes against everything the United States stands for and was ever built upon and ever hopes to be.
Kevin, can you tell our viewers exactly what happened? Did you have a visit from the FBI? OFAC gave you information. Tell us how the information was transferred to you that you should not travel or participate in the conference that was going to be held in Lebanon.
Well, first I heard from some friends of mine, Sandra Hicks and indeed Mike Springman were among them, who had actually had visits or contacts from the FBI about this. And then my phone rang shortly thereafter. And it was the local FBI guy from Madison, Wisconsin. And he wanted to try to set up an interview with me. And he said it was about New Horizon. And we had a brief conversation. And I admitted to him, yes, I understand that you're telling me I can't go to the New Horizon conference or I'll be arrested on the way back. He agreed with that, so that was he confirmed that information, which I'd already heard from other people who'd actually had the FBI at their doorsteps early in the morning. But in my case, it was fortunately just this phone call, and so I said, "Yes, I'll sit down and talk with you about this because I have no secrets. I think everybody needs to hear about this, but I need to record it because I don't want to be misrepresented." And so he checked with the superior, and they said, "No, the FBI will not allow you to record the conversation with the FBI."
I think we're having some technical problems there with Kevin. What about you, Anthony? I mean, you're Canadian, so were you not told not to attend the conference? Did you have any problems? Because I understand that you did go to Lebanon. Did you have any problems when you returned?
No, I didn't. I never have. I've always just come straight back into Canada, and I've never been interrogated in any way on what happens to me on the trip.
Let's talk about the conference in Lebanon that the United States was so afraid of. Anthony, tell us about the conference. What was taking place there that Washington feared so much?
Well, it was quite something to be having a New Horizon conference on the shores of the Mediterranean. And I think the reality is that since 2014, when I went to my first New Horizon conference, and 2019, the influence of Iran has expanded westward. And, Iran has been exercising a certain amount of widened influence. And so obviously that seemed to be frightening the United States, the U.S. government, the fact that this was taking place in Lebanon. And it was fascinating for me to go up to the border of Israel, for instance, at the Iranian park on the border of Israel in Lebanon. I wasn't aware of such a thing. It was fascinating to get to know Hezbollah, to meet people in it, and find that, it's every sort of grandmother and child, and it's the entire society in the south of Lebanon might be considered Hezbollah. It was eye-opening in many ways. And what was also eye-opening was the fact that the U.S. government has become so petrified of allowing discourse and free exchange of ideas in the type of milieu that we've developed and cultivated at New Horizons that the U.S. Was showing itself and taking such a repressive act, which of course is now becoming commonplace as the Biden group prepared to define all the basic Trump supporters, I guess you could say the deplorables, as domestic terrorists. So much of this injustice and prevention of due process, free speech, and innocent until proven guilty goes forward in the name of terrorism. Now it seems that the U.S. has become so conversant with using this technique to repress people that it's about to do it on its own citizens, on a huge swath of its own citizens.
And hopefully you guys will continue to be somewhat free to talk about the reality here in Iran. I appreciate all of you being with me for this program looking at the New Horizon Conference. Author and former diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. Editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett out of Madison, and editor-in-chief of American Herald Tribune, Anthony Hall out of Lethbridge. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself right here in Tehran and all the crew.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be examining a question which often comes up in the minds of people. It's also a point of contention amongst the Islamic sects that exist today. And that question is this. What exactly do we mean by worship in the phrase monotheism in worship? What do we mean by the phrase, the word worship, when we say that we should only worship God? A lot of people are of the assumption that this means that one should not humble oneself before anybody besides God. Worship means humility. Ibadat in the Arabic language lexically means humility, to be humble before something. So tawheed fil ibadat, or directing one's ibadat and worship only to God, means that one should only be humble towards God. This idea is wrong. Why? Because we see in the Holy Quran that God has ordered us to be humble towards beings besides Him. This surely shows us that this is permissible. So this is not the meaning of worship in the phrase monotheism in worship. And this is not the kind of worship that should only be performed and directed and oriented towards God. So what then is this worship that only belongs to God, and God is the only being who deserves to be worshipped? The answer to this question is this, that the worship that solely belongs to God and only God deserves is the worship, is the humility that is accompanied by the belief that the being that one is humbling oneself towards is the creator of the person humbling him, being humble, his Lord and his owner. Therefore, if somebody humbles oneself before another being because he believes that this being is his creator, his Lord and his owner, in this case, this person is performing an act of polytheism in worship, in the technical sense of the term. Otherwise, if he's simply humbling himself before this person, but doesn't believe that this person is his creator, or his Lord, or his owner, then this is not an act of polytheism, even though it's an act of humility, and the person is worshipping and doing ibadah to him in the lexical sense of the term, but in the technical sense of the term, he's not worshipping him, and he's not worshipping something other than God, and this is okay. Why do we say this, and what's the proof for this? The proof for this is that we can understand this by taking a look at the first surah of the Holy Quran, Surah Fatiha. In Surah Fatiha, in the middle of Surah Fatiha, when we say, Iyaka na'budu wa iyaka nasta'in, O Lord, thee alone do we worship, and thee alone do we beseech for help. Prior to this, there's a series of verses which enumerate certain attributes and beautiful names of God. For example, we say, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. All praises due to God. Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, the most beneficent, the most merciful. So we attribute him with being the Lord of the worlds. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. One. Secondly, we say, Maliki Yawmiddin, the owner and master of the day of judgment. Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, the most beneficent, the merciful. Then we say, Iyaka Na'budu wa Iyaka Nasta'in. So, this worship that's accompanied by the belief that this being is my Lord, he's my creator, he's my master, he's the most beneficent, the most merciful, such an act of humility should only be directed towards God. Otherwise, if it's not accompanied by this belief, it's okay. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining the meaning of worship and monotheism in worship. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The world is curious about the future direction of the relationship between China and the United States. Tensions between the two major strategic rivals skyrocketed under former U.S. President Donald Trump. The former president seemed very proud of his tough line on the world's second largest economy. He launched a trade war against China and blamed it for starting the devastating COVID-19 pandemic. Now his successor, Joe Biden, is still reviewing America's strategy towards its number one rival. This week, he announced a Defense Department review of its China strategy as part of a broader effort to decide how his team will deal with Beijing. Now a newly formed task force at the U.S. Department of Defense will study the military strategy regarding China in different areas. Biden does not seem to have any illusions about the formidable challenges posed by the Chinese. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to lead an international effort to pressure, isolate, and punish China. This week, in his first phone call with the Chinese President Xi Jinping, Biden tried to press his counterpart on several issues, including trade practices, Hong Kong, and ongoing tensions with Taiwan. The American president underscored his fundamental concerns, but the Chinese president told his U.S. counterpart that he hoped Washington would approach matters of sovereignty and territorial integrity cautiously. She warned that confrontation would be disastrous for both sides.
There is a significant lack of trust on the part of both sides. Nobody's going to rush into anything at this moment under pressing conditions. But if they can find some individual items in which they can cooperate, COVID obviously is one of the areas which are affecting both countries.
The United States has been trying hard to contain China in terms of economy and military power. Such efforts were intensified over the past years, but fulfilling that goal is proving to be increasingly difficult, with China's military might increasing and its economy expanding despite the pandemic that has battered the American economy. Some estimates show that China will overtake the U.S. and become the world's largest economy sometime in this decade. This is undoubtedly keeping the Americans on the edge. These concerns were echoed by U.S. President Joe Biden this week. During a meeting with a bipartisan group of senators soon after his phone call with the Chinese leader, Biden issued a stark warning. If we don't get moving, they're going to eat our lunch. Biden warned that the Chinese are investing very heavily to deal with a whole range of issues, including transportation and the environment. The American president said the U.S. just has to immediately step up infrastructure spending. How will Biden try to counter China? Is there any room left for cooperation? Chinese officials insist that there is still a possibility.
It's kind of a light at the end of what will probably be a very long tunnel if we are to repair the U.S.-China relationship. But I think that the statement made by President Biden in his foreign policy address, which was also pretty hard-hitting with regard to China, but nevertheless, he said that they will cooperate in those issues which are in the interest of the United States. And then, of course, the call on a very important, prior just to the very important Spring Festival, I think sent a very good signal to the Chinese that maybe there was a way to create some kind of a new connection between the U.S. and China.
But will America move to reduce tensions? U.S. officials have said there would be no quick moves to remove tariffs on Chinese imports. The White House could even impose new targeted restrictions on sensitive technology exports to China. Experts say under Biden, the two sides will probably find a pathway to stabilize their relationship, but neither side will budge on key issues.
When former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, it also withdrew from any right of comment as to the ongoing agreement, meaning that in order for the U.S. to reconsider joining the accord, it must abide by the terms and conditions of the original plan and respect the wishes of the incumbent members. Yet with Donald Trump now out of the picture, current U.S. President Joe Biden has expressed an interest in rejoining the JCPOA, as demonstrated by his selection of advisors and foreign policy chiefs. However, Iran has warned the 46th president that the time frame for having the right to rejoin the table is fast running out as the window of opportunity tightens on the US. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, specified that certain events and circumstances in Iran meant that should the US not hasten its act in showing genuine intention of rejoining the JCPOA, it may find that the door firmly shuts behind it, leaving the US out of the cold when it comes to the agreement. And this was reiterated by Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. Zarif went on to explain that should Biden continue to demonstrate cold feet when making the first move by totally lifting the US-imposed sanctions on Iran, then he could risk tarnishing his name with the same brush as Donald Trump, hence failing to shake off the Trump legacy and creating a new one of his own. However, the United States Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, suggested it was for Iran to take the first step. However, this rationale defies all logic because, as mentioned, by withdrawing from the JCPOA under Trump, the US, or for that matter, any other non-member of the accord, have no right to comment or suggest what steps should be taken, with the onus of good faith actually placed on their shoulders to prove that their intentions are genuine, rather than vice versa. Iran has seen itself grow as a nation over the last 42 years since the overthrow of the Pahlavi regime in the 1979 Islamic Revolution. It fought an 8-year war against Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, overcame multiple challenges, and proved itself to be a regional player across a host of fields. Yet as Iran recently celebrated the 42 years of the Islamic Revolution, it's also worth taking a moment to analyze just how Iran has been able to demonstrate self-sufficiency, even during the toughest of times. With sanctions aimed at crippling Iran's economic power, Donald Trump's so-called maximum pressure policy failed miserably as Iran stood up to the challenge, showing how in spite of the best attempts by Trump to break the country from within, the people of the nation still stood firm and proud against the economic terrorism imposed by Trump, with the Iranian foreign minister blaming Trump's failure on his incompetent advisors.
I believe President Trump unfortunately does not have good advisors. He's been waiting for Iranian government's collapse since he withdrew from the nuclear deal. At that time, John Bolton promised him that maximum pressure will bring us to our knees within a few months.
Furthermore, Iran has also demonstrated its regional and global intentions in its successful defeat of the US-backed Daesh terrorist group, led by the skill and strategy of martyred Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, proving to the world that Iran is a force for peace around the world. With too many achievements to name, Iran has demonstrated to the world that it's a nation that complies with international law and regulations, as well as showing that it can stand up to the bullies and agitators in the region who try to destabilize the security of the area, hence raising the question as to just why Iran should be the ones that take the first step to invite the US back to the JCPOA table. The polar opposite is true for the United States, who have over the last 4 years done nothing more than demonstrate their warmongering and state-sponsored aggression to the world, hence raising doubt as to whether Joe Biden's intentions to rejoin the JCPOA are actually genuine at all. With palaces, country residence, land and real estate, the Windsor family of Britain are one of the wealthiest in the country, and their royal rule comes as part and parcel of the British establishment. However, yet another dark side of the royal family has emerged, this time surrounding their personal wealth and investments. A report by investigative journalist published in the Guardian newspaper has revealed that Queen Elizabeth lobbied the then government of Edward Heath to change a law in order to hide her private wealth. The deal, which was agreed between the governments of Heath and Wilson, allowed the British state to create a state-backed shell company, which was designed to place a veil of secrecy over the royals' wealth, which had the value have been leaked, would have been very embarrassing for the Windsors. With the majority of British people in the 1970s living in hardship as the effects of the oil crisis and unemployment hit hard, why then did the British Queen want to hide her enormous wealth from her loyal subjects?
Of course, we have to remember that although the story is new, it's actually really dates back to the 1970s, just now that the relevant government documents have been released, and that so the Guardian was able to cover the story. And at that time, the Queen was very anxious that her private wealth be a secret, that people shouldn't know how much she was worth. She was estimated to be the richest woman in the world at the time, but that is no longer the case. But certainly, they would have felt at that time, in the 1970s, that the wish for secrecy was justified. But in today's world, it's very different. We expect much greater transparency.
With the law proposed to Heath, yet passed by his successor, Harold Wilson, the Queen's assets were quickly passed into the shell company, hence removing immediate layers of traceable wealth to the Queen, and remained in place until at least 2011. The ability for the Queen to pass such laws comes from an ancient law called the Queen's Consent, and evidence suggests that this law was used as far back as 1728. Yet, by applying this law in the 1970s, and now even in modern days, unknown to the public, the law breaks the norm of the monarchy respecting government independence, suggesting the royal family are not as transparent and clear as they portray to be. Britain, and in particular the royal family, are in fact the polar opposite of what a democracy should be, with an unelected royal family who rule by air and not consent, and a government that has on many occasions won an election with a minority vote. One has to question just how free Britain really is. With the ultra-elite being so readily able to hide their wealth, does this mean that such acts can be applied to the wider political spectrum? After all, if it's good enough for the goose, it's good enough for the gander.
There's been quite a lot of dismay in among the British public recently about the way the government has been handing billions of pounds of public money used for PPE in the COVID crisis and also for the awards of contracts for people for search and trace, for example, track and trace. And really the problem today is that we don't know who exactly is getting the money. We know the amounts of money involved, but there's a great deal of secrecy about how many of these people are or companies linked to individuals who are in the government or who are donors to the ruling Conservative Party.
Yet there are some in Britain who have defended the Queen, in particular from the biased and pro-British establishment Daily Express newspaper, whose columnist Richard Kay stated that the evidence supplied by the Guardian newspaper is, quote, hardly compelling, and he fails to believe that the Queen conspired with the government to hide her wealth. Whereas the story will unlikely rock the popularity of the royal family amongst the hardcore British faithful, the fact that the story has emerged shows that there are people in Britain who are willing to dig up the truth and seek to expose the royal family for who they really are. With Britain at one of its lowest ever points since World War II, and with COVID-19 tearing the economy and lives apart, as well as the impact of Brexit now being felt in a way Britain would not care to admit, as cries of nationalism and independence echo across the United Kingdom and the north of Ireland, one can only wonder just what else the Queen has tried to hide from law, as she tries in vain to hold together not only her estranged family, but her entire country and legacy in the process.
On Sunday, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, reiterated Iran's position that it will reverse its scaleback of commitments under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal only after the United States goes back to full compliance with the international accord. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that Iran will first verify that all sanctions are lifted, not on paper or by words, but in action, and then will restore its commitments to the deal. The remarks come as Iran and United States seem to have reached a standoff, with both asking the other to act first to salvage the nuclear agreement, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. This is while the United States under former President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from the accord in May 2018 and imposed sanctions on Iran as part of its so-called maximum pressure campaign. Tehran, however, remained fully compliant with the deal for an entire year. But as the remaining European parties failed to fulfill their end of the bargain, Iran began in May 2019 to scale back some of its JCPOA commitments in several steps under Articles 26 and 36 of the accord covering Tehran's legal rights.
Returning to the deal provides a lot of gains for everybody on both sides and the rest of the world for reality. And for Iran, it means lifting of all the sanctions that have harmed the economy and the medical health of the population living a pandemic. For the United States, it will mean that there will be less possibility of confrontation with Iran, that there's possibilities of creating a more stable region. But looking at how the United States, its main interest in the region is to control it and its resources, This is probably why some of the United States and its local vessels like Apartheid Israel and Saudi Arabia are not really happy with the deal, because it's in their interest to have conflict where the region's resources can be extracted.
Iran has time and again noted that these steps are reversible if all parties to the nuclear deal go back to strict compliance with their obligations. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif warned that the clock is ticking for the U.S., referring to the Iranian parliament's legislation passed late last year that demands a further expansion to Iran's scale-back within a three-month time frame, as well as the upcoming Iranian presidential election. Biden said on Sunday that the U.S. won't lift sanctions on Iran first.
Will the U.S. lift sanctions first in order to get Iran back to the negotiating table?
No.
They have to stop enriching uranium first.
This is while reports show the Biden administration is mulling easing some sanctions without lifting key ones as a step toward reviving the JCPOA. Sources familiar with the matter say the options include those based on humanitarian grounds, such as providing backing for International Monetary Fund lending to Tehran for coronavirus relief.
Right now, the United States is refusing to do what is just, which is to go back to the deal that it broke and it moved out of, and lift the sanctions for then Iran to return to its obligations. And we heard today Mr. President Biden saying that they have no intention of taking basically the first move, that the United States is expecting Iran to get back to its obligations. And obviously that means the United States has not accepted that it violated the treaty.
But Iran's position is clear. No going back to full compliance unless all parties to the deal are back on track.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Thank you.
the limelight.
The White House has announced that President Joe Biden intends to shut down the notorious U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay by the time he leaves office, a tall task that the Obama administration failed to achieve nearly a decade ago. The Biden administration press secretary, Jen Psaki, said recently that it was the intention of the Biden administration to shutter the offshore prison, which was set up in January of 2002 to hold people suspected of ties to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in the wake of the suspicious 11th of September 2001 attacks. We present you an article written jointly by Matt Spetelnik, Trevor Honeycutt, and Phil Stewart. The piece is titled, Can Biden Remove Guantanamo's Stain from U.S. Rights Record? The article has been taken from the Reuters news agency. The White House confirmed on Friday, 12th of February, that President Joe Biden's aides have launched a formal review of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, reviving the Obama-era goal of closing the controversial facility with the aim of doing so before Biden leaves office. Two people familiar with the matter told Reuters news agency that aides involved in internal discussions are considering an executive action to be signed by Joe Biden in coming weeks or months, signaling a purported new effort to remove what human rights advocates have called a stain on America's global image. Asked whether President Biden would shut the high-security prison located at Guantanamo Bay Naval Station by the time his presidency ends, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed, "That certainly is our goal and our intention. But such an initiative is unlikely to bring down the curtain anytime soon on the offshore facility, due largely to the steep political and legal obstacles that also frustrated the so-called efforts by his ex-boss, former President Barack Obama, to shut down Guantanamo. Set up to house foreign suspects following the suspicious 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington, the prison came to symbolize the excesses of the U.S. so-called war on terrorism because of harsh interrogation methods and torture that has been used extensively at the prison." National Security Council spokeswoman Emily Horn said, "We are undertaking an NSC process to assess the current state of play that the Biden administration has inherited from the previous administration, in line with our broader goal of closing down Guantanamo." The National Security Council spokeswoman, Emily Horn, added, "The National Security Council, NSC, will work closely with the Department of Defense, with the Department of State, and the Justice Department to make progress towards closing down the Guantanamo facility, and also in close consultation with U.S. Congress." The immediate impact of a new approach could be to reinstate, in some form, Barack Obama's Guantanamo closure policy, which was reversed by Donald Trump as soon as he took office in January of 2017. Donald Trump kept the prison open during his 4 years in the White House. Now 40 prisoners remain at Guantanamo, most held for nearly two decades, without being charged or even tried. Joe Biden's campaign claimed during the 2020 presidential race that he continued to support closing down the detention center, but did not say how he would do it. It is also unclear how specific Biden's coming executive action might be about his plans for the prison, which holds suspects in the suspicious 9/11 attacks among its detainee population. signaling that deliberations are still at an early stage. Emily Horn added, a number of key policy roles still need to be filled, including ones at the Defense Department, the Pentagon, at the State Department, and at the Department of Justice. Emily Horn claimed, we need to have the right people seated to do this important work. Opened under President George W. Bush, the prison's population grew to a peak of about 800 inmates before it started to shrink. Barack Obama whittled down the number of prisoners further with his effort to close the prison, but that effort was stymied largely by Republican opposition in the Congress. The federal government is still barred by law from transferring any inmates to prisons on mainland United States. Even with his own Democratic Party now controlling Congress, their majorities are so slim that Joe Biden would face a tough challenge securing legislative changes because some Democrats might also oppose them. According to the people familiar with the matter, a revived Guantanamo strategy is expected to focus initially on further decreasing the number of prisoners held at the facility by repatriating them or finding other countries willing to accept them. The sources said this could also mean reestablishing a State Department post of Guantanamo closure envoy, created by Barack Obama but eliminated by Donald Trump, to resume negotiations with other governments on detainee transfers. The sources added, in addition, the Pentagon could restart a parole-style review process of prisoners' cases to determine whether, as the U.S. officials claiming, they still pose a threat. Still, any closure plan could initially be hampered by the coronavirus pandemic, making moving prisoners unlikely for now. Just over 3 weeks after taking office, the Biden administration has not made Guantanamo one of its top early priorities as it grapples with the coronavirus pandemic and the economic fallout from the pandemic. Barack Obama made closing Guantanamo one of his first executive orders in 2009, but failed to do so by the end of his second term in office. Andrea Prasso, Deputy Washington Director for Human Rights Watch, says, while I'm glad to hear that the new administration will be reviewing policy with an eye towards closing down Guantanamo, it's concerning that it is coming so late in the game. Shutting the facility has been a purported demand of progressive Democrats whose support helped Joe Biden win the White House. Critics say the prison's continued existence is a reminder of detention practices that opened the United States to charges of torture and abuse. Privately, administration officials expressed skepticism about getting the support they will need from U.S. Congress. America's new Defense Secretary Lord Austin's statement during his January confirmation hearing that the new administration would seek Guantanamo's closure through a letter of rebuke signed by seven Republican House members, all military veterans. U.S. Representative Mike Waltz, one of the signatories of the letter, in a tweet claimed, if we release these Guantanamo detainees, they'll become rock stars in the extremist world, posing an even greater threat to America and to the world. Of the prisoners who remain at Guantanamo, nine have been charged or convicted by military commissions. The most notorious is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the accused September 11 mastermind. About 24 prisoners have not been charged, but have been deemed too dangerous to release. Six inmates have previously been cleared for release by a government panel, yet remain in prison with no arrangements for their transfer. The Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, also known as Gitmo, became synonymous with prisoner abuse by the United States in the early years of the so-called War on Terror, because of harsh interrogation methods that human rights advocates said amounted to torture. The administration of former President George W. Bush had selected Guantanamo, a desolate place near the eastern tip of Cuba, because it was under full control of the U.S. military and relatively close to the U.S. mainland, but beyond the reach of American courts of law. The idea was that if the detainees, who were being captured and transferred in droves from Afghanistan and from elsewhere, were held away from U.S. soil, they would have no legal right to seek a judge's order of habeas corpus, which provides protection against unlawful imprisonment. The Guantanamo detainees were subjected to abuse, to humiliation, and to torture as part of their interrogations, the accounts of which were gradually exposed to the outside world by the few inspectors who visited the prison and some of the inmates themselves who were later released. Critics say Guantanamo's continued existence is a reminder to the world of harsh interrogation practices and torture methods used by the United States that former President Barack Obama once admitted were a stain on our border record. The renewed push to close down the prison is seen as a so-called attempt by the Biden administration to remove that stain from America's global image. More than 100 human rights organizations signed a letter to Joe Biden earlier this month, calling on him to shut down Guantanamo and end the indefinite detention of suspects held in the maximum security prison. According to the open letter, Guantanamo continues to cause escalating and profound damage to the men who still languish there, and the approach it exemplifies continues to fuel and justify bigotry, stereotyping, and stigma. It remains to be seen whether the new Biden administration can overcome the obstacles and make good on Joe Biden's promise to close the notorious prison once and for all.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. We have all heard the famous saying, survival of the fittest, right? And when we talk about survival of the fittest, it is usually associated with being ruthless, with being selfish, with, you know, minding your own business, not getting distracted by life's drama, even if it means, you know, helping other people out, taking time out of your day, sacrificing your energy and your time and your work or whatever to help improve other people's lives and situations. Survival of the fittest means that it's a dog-eat-dog kind of world and this and that. But even Darwin himself believed, who, by the way, studied human evolution, believed that mankind is not naturally or biologically competitive or that self-centered as we might think he is. As a matter of fact, Darwin believed that we are profoundly social beings, that caring and being kind is what's innate and biological about us. We are such social beings that I was reading an article a while back talking about a hospital where their nursery had a section basically that would take care of abandoned newborns, and they would take in volunteers to come and just hold these newborns and have skin-to-skin contact with them during the first few weeks of those newborns, those infants' development, because otherwise there was the fear of the infants dying if they could not have that human contact. That's how social we are. Now, what does that have to do with kindness? Well, how about we listen to a short story on this matter and continue our discussion after that? Stay with us.
The hotel clerk who helped the couple. We have an interesting story for today. On a stormy night many years ago, an elderly man and his wife entered the lobby of a small hotel in Philadelphia, USA. The couple approached the front desk hoping to get some shelter for the night. "Could you possibly give us a room here?" the husband asked. The clerk, a friendly man, looked at the couple and explained that there were three conventions in town. "All of our rooms are taken," the clerk said. "But I can't send a nice couple like you out into the rain at night. Would you perhaps be willing to sleep in my room?" When the couple declined, the young man pressed on. "Don't worry about me. I'll make out just fine," the clerk told them. So the couple agreed. As he paid his bill the next morning, the elderly man said to the clerk, "You are the kind of manager who should be the boss of the best hotel. Maybe someday I'll build one for you." The clerk looked at them and smiled. 2 years passed. The clerk had almost forgotten the incident when he received a letter from the old man. He recalled that stormy night and enclosed a round trip ticket to New York, asking the young man to pay them a visit. The old man met him in New York and led him to the corner of 5th Avenue and 34th Street. Then he pointed to a great new building there, with watchtowers thrusting up to the sky. "That," said the old man, "is the hotel I have just built for you to manage." "You must be joking," the young man said. "I can assure you I'm not," said the old man. The old man's name was William Waldorf Astor, and that structure was the original Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The young clerk who became its first manager was George C. Bolt. This young clerk never foresaw the turn of events that would lead him to become the top man of one of the world's most glamorous hotels.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
I was having a very interesting discussion with one of my friends, and they were saying that this kindness that we are constantly told, especially I don't know, maybe 2019, 2018, onwards, especially during 2020, because the world was, you know, being totally chaotic on steroids. This idea of being kind to myself can find its roots and source in the fact that Allah chooses to be kind toward me. If He wasn't kind toward me, He wouldn't provide me with so many blessings, not just materialistic, but the spiritual blessings that would help me find my way back to Him again. If He wasn't kind to me, and if He didn't love me, He wouldn't give me that opportunity or that even acknowledgement that there is a truth beyond myself and that I need to better myself and try everything in my power to obtain that truth. So basically, and if we want to talk about the different ways of being kind, well, the ahadith and narrations from the Ahlul Bayt talk about this topic in numerous, almost countless occasions. Kindness could be an act of charity. Charity can be giving food, giving clothing, giving money to those who are in need. Charity could even be sharing a piece of knowledge with someone and increasing their wisdom and understanding of the world. Charity can be a simple smile that you give to someone that, you know, could shift their emotions and their focus from something perhaps negative that's going on inside them. Charity can be the time we spend with our loved ones, even our family members, that quality time we spend with our kids, our nieces, our nephews, the patience and tolerance we express and we display toward our neighbors, because neighbors can be loud, they can leave their trash in front of the door, they can, you know, in a little plastic bag, not just toss their trash in front of the door, that'd be gross. They could, you know, forget to close, shut the gate, or things like that. That level of tolerance that we have toward our neighbors can be an act of charity within itself, can be an act of kindness. It's recognized in religion as being an act of kindness. Also, one way to be kind is to be kind toward people's mental state. You know, the idea of checking up on someone, making sure that they're okay. We will always have that one friend, two friends that are always struggling with something, if we happen to, you know it. Kindness would be to actively make it an objective to check up on that someone and reassuring them every once in a while that you are there for them if they should ever need it, that it's okay for them to reach out to you and ask you for help, and that you've made it a sort of purpose in your life to be available for these people. And nothing should be taken for granted. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said that a small act of kindness, even if it's a nickel or a dime or a dollar, is better than no kindness at all. So don't ever tell yourself this is so little, I'm so ashamed to be giving a dollar, or I'm so ashamed to be giving the other half of my sandwich. Don't ever say that. Think of the person who is evaluating your act of kindness and the fact that he is limitless and he looks at your intention. And if your intention is to please him with your small act, he will magnify it for you and he will give it back to you tenfold. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.